rose more steeply, then settled as she released his nose and pulled away from him. She bent to one side and spoke into his ear in a low voice. "Come back to us, David. We need you, and you need us." She breathed deep into his mouth again and said, "Come back to us, David," as he exhaled a mixture of his air and hers. She looked into his face. His unassisted breathing was a little stronger now, she thought, and she could see his eyeballs moving beneath his blue-tinged lids, but he showed no signs of waking up. "Come back to us, David. Come back." Johnny looked around, blinking like someone just back from the further reaches of his thoughts. "Where's Mary? You don't suppose the goddamn balcony fell on her, do you?" "Why would it have?" Steve asked. "She was with the old guy." "And you think she's still with the old guy? After all the yelling? After the goddamn balcony fell off the goddamn wall?" "You've got a point," Steve said. "Here we go again," Johnny said. "I knew it. Come on, I guess we better go and look for her." Cynthia took no notice. She knelt with her face in front of David's, searching it earnestly with her eyes. "I don't know where you are, kid, but get your ass back here. It's time to saddle up and get out of Dodge." Johnny picked up the shotgun and the rifle. He handed the latter to Ralph. "Stay here with your boy and the young lady," he said. "We'll be back." "Yeah? What if you're not?" Johnny looked at him uncertainly for a moment, then broke into a sunny grin. "Burn the documents, trash the radio, and swallow your death capsule." "Huh? How the fuck should I know? Use your judgment. I can tell you this much, Ralph. As soon as we've collected Ms. Jackson, we're totally historical. Come on, Steve. Down the far left-hand aisle, unless you've an urge to climb Mount Balcony." Ralph watched them through the door, then turned back to Cynthia and his son. "What's wrong with David? Do you have any idea? Did that bitch choke him into a coma? He had a friend who was in a coma once, David did. He came out of it. It was a miracle, everyone said. But I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. Is that what's wrong with him, do you think?" "I don't think he's unconscious at all, let alone in a coma. Do you see the way his eyelids are moving? It's more like he's asleep and dreaming, or in a trance." She looked up at him. Their eyes met for a moment, and then Ralph knelt down across from her. He brushed his son's hair off his brow, and then kissed him gently between the eyes, where the skin was puckered in a faint frown. "Come back, David," he said. "Please come back." David breathed quietly through pursed lips. Behind his bruised eyelids, his eyes moved and moved. 4. In the men's room, they found one dead cougar, its head mostly blown off, and one dead veterinarian with his eyes open. In the ladies' room, they found nothing, or so it seemed to Steve. "Shine your light back over there," Johnny told him. When Steve retrained the flashlight on the window, he said, "No, not the window, the floor underneath it." Steve dropped the beam and ran it along half a dozen beer bottles standing against the wall just to the right of the window. "The doc's booby trap," Johnny said. "Not broken, but neatly set aside." "Interesting. I didn't even notice they were gone from the window ledge. That's good on you, boss." "Come on over here." Johnny crossed to the window, held it up, peeked out, then moved aside enough for Steve to join him. "Cast your mind back to your arrival at this bucolic palace of dreams, Stephen. What's the last thing you did before sliding all the way into this room? Can you remember?" Steve nodded. "Sure. We stacked two crates to make it easier to climb in the window. I pushed the top one off because I figured if the cop came back here and saw them piled up that way, it would be like a pointing arrow." "Right. But what do you see now?" Steve used his flashlight, although he didn't really need to. The wind had died almost completely, and all but the most errant skims of dust had dropped. There was even a scantling of moon. "They're stacked up again," he said, and turned to Johnny with an alarmed look. "Oh, shit. Entragian came while we were occupied with David. Came and..." "Took her" was how he meant to finish, but he saw the boss shaking his head and stopped. That's not what this says. Johnny took the flashlight and ran it along the row of bottles again. Not smashed, set neatly aside in a row. Who did that? Audrey? No, she went the other way, after David. Billingsley? Not possible, considering the shape he was in before he died. That leaves Mary, but would she have done it for the cop?
I doubt it, Steve said.
Me too. I think that if the cop had shown up back here, she would have come running to us, screaming bloody murder. And why the stacked crates? I've got some personal experience of Collie and Trajan. He's 6'6" at least, probably more. He wouldn't have needed a step up to get in the window. To me, those stacked crates suggest either a shorter person, a ruse to get Mary into a position where she could be grabbed, or maybe both. I could be over-deducing, I suppose, but...
So there could be more of them, more like Audrey.
Maybe, but I don't think you can conclude that out of what we see here. I just don't think she would have put those beer bottles aside for any stranger, not even a bawling little kid, you know? I think she would have come to get us. Steve took the flashlight and shone it on Billingsley's tile fish, so joyful and funky here in the dark. He wasn't surprised to find that he no longer liked it much. Now it was like laughter in a haunted house, or a clown at midnight. He snapped the light off.
What are you thinking, boss?
Don't call me that anymore, Steve. I never liked it that much to begin with.
All right. What are you thinking, Johnny?
Johnny looked around to make sure they were still alone. His face, dominated by his swelled and leaning nose, looked both tired and intent. As he shook out another 3 aspirin and dry swallowed them, Steve realized an amazing thing. Marinville looked younger. In spite of everything he'd been through, he looked younger. He swallowed again, grimacing at the taste of the old pills, and said,
David's mom. What?
It could have been. Take a second. Think about it. You'll see how pretty it is in a ghastly kind of way. Steve did, and saw how completely it made sense of the situation. He didn't know where Audrey Weiler's story had parted company from the truth, but he did know that at some point she had been gotten to, changed by the stones she had called the Cantas. Changed, afflicted with a kind of horrible degenerative rabies. What had happened to her could have happened to Ellen Carver as well. Steve suddenly found himself hoping Mary Jackson was dead. That was awful, but in a case like this, dead might be better, mightn't it? Better than being under the spell of the Cantas. Better than what apparently happened when the Cantas were taken away.
What do we do now? He asked.
Get out of this town, by any means possible.
All right. If David's still unconscious, we'll carry him. Let's do it.
They started back to the lobby. 5. David Carver walked down Anderson Avenue past West Wentworth Middle School. Written on the side of the school building in yellow spray paint were the words, "In these silences, something may rise." Then he turned an Ohio corner and began walking down Bear Street. That was pretty funny, since Bear Street and the Bear Street Woods were 9 big suburban blocks from the junior high, but that's the way things worked in dreams. Soon he would wake up in his own bedroom, and the whole thing would fall apart anyway. Ahead of him were 3 bikes in the middle of the street. They had been turned upside down, and their wheels were spinning in the air.
"And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I have dreamed a dream," someone said, "and I have heard say of thee that thou canst understand a dream, to interpret it."
David looked across the street and saw Reverend Martin. He was drunk, and he needed a shave. In one hand, he held a bottle of Seagram 7 whiskey. Between his feet was a yellow puddle of puke. David could barely stand to look at him. His eyes were empty and dead.
"And Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, It is not in me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace. Reverend Martin toasted him with the bottle and then drank. Go get 'em, he said. Now we're going to discover if you know where Moses was when the lights went out. David walked on. He thought of turning around. Then a queer but strangely persuasive idea came to him. If he did turn around, he would see the mummy tottering after him in a cloud of ancient wrappings and spices. He walked a little faster. As he passed the bikes in the street, he noted that one of the turning wheels made a piercing and unpleasant sound. Reek, reek, reek. It made him think of the weather vane on top of Bud Suds, the leprechaun with the pot of gold under his arm, the one in... Desperation. I'm in desperation, and this is a dream. I fell asleep while I was trying to pray. I'm upstairs in the old movie theater. There shall arise among you a prophet and a dreamer of dreams, someone said. David looked across the street and saw a dead cat, a cougar, hanging from a speed limit sign. The cougar had a human head, Audrey Weiler's head. Her eyes rolled at him tiredly, and he thought she was trying to smile. But if he should say to you, let us seek other gods, you shall not hearken unto him. He looked away, grimacing, and here, on his own side of Bear Street, was Sweet Pie standing on the porch of his friend Brian's house. Brian's house had never been on Bear Street before, but now the rules had apparently changed. She was holding Melissa's sweetheart clasped in her arms. He was Mr. Big Boogeyman after all, she said. You know that now, don't you? Yes, I know, Pie. Walk a little faster, David. Mr. Big Boogeyman's after you. The desert smell of wrappings and old spices was stronger in his nose now, and David walked faster still. Up ahead was the break in the bushes which marked the entrance to the Ho Chi Minh Trail. There had never been anything there before but the occasional hopscotch grid or Kathy Loves Russell chalked on the sidewalk. But today the entrance to the path was guarded by an ancient stone statue, one much too big to be a Kanta, little god. This was a Kantak, big god. It was a jackal with a cocked head, an open, snarling mouth, and buggy cartoon eyes that were full of fury. One of its ears had either been chipped away or eroded away. The tongue in its mouth was not a tongue at all, but a human head. Collie and Trajan's head, Smoky Bear hat and all. Fear me, and turn aside from this path, the cop in the mouth of the jackal said as David approached. Me toe, candy latch, fear the unformed. There are other gods than yours. Kanta, Kantak, you know I speak the truth. Yes, but my God is strong, David said in a conversational voice. He reached into the jackal's open mouth and seized its psychotic tongue. He heard Antragian scream, and felt it, a scream that vibrated against his palm like a joy buzzer. A moment later, the jackal's entire head exploded in a soundless, shardless flash of light. What remained was a stone hulk that stopped short at the shoulders. He walked down the path, aware that he was glimpsing plants he had never seen anywhere in Ohio before. Spiny cactuses and drum cactuses, winter fat, squaw tea, Russian thistle, also known as tumbleweed. From the bushes at the side of the path stepped his mother. Her face was black and wrinkled, an ancient bag of dough. Her eyes drooped. The sight of her in this state filled him with sorrow and horror. Yes, yes, your God is strong, she said. No argument there. But look what he's done to me. Is this strength worth admiring? Is this a God worth having? She held her hands out to him, displaying her rotting palms. God didn't do that, David said, and began to cry. The policeman did it. But God let it happen, she countered, and one of her eyeballs dropped out of her head. The same God who let Antragian push Kirsten downstairs and then hang her body on a hook for you to find. What God is this? Turn aside from him and embrace mine. Mine is at least honest about his cruelty. But this whole conversation, not just the petitioning, but the haughty, threatening tone of it, was so foreign to David's memory of his mother that he began to walk forward again. Had to walk forward again. The mummy was behind him, and the mummy was slow, yes, but he reckoned that this was one of the ways in which the mummy caught up with his victims, by using his ancient Egyptian magic to put obstacles in their path. "Stay away from me," the rotting mother thing screamed. "Stay away, or I'll turn you to stone in the mouth of a god. You'll be Kanta in Kantak." "You can't do that," David said patiently, "and you're not my mother. My mother's with my sister, in heaven, with God." "What a joke," the rotting thing cried indignantly. Its voice was gargly now, like the cop's voice. It was spitting blood and teeth as it talked. "Heaven's a joke. The kind of thing your Reverend Martin would spiel happily on about for hours if you kept buying him shots and beers. It's no more real than Tom Billingsley's Fishes and Horses. You won't tell me you swallowed it, will you? A smart boy like you? Did you? Oh, Davy, I don't know whether to laugh or cry." What she did was to smile furiously. "There's no heaven, no afterlife at all, not for such as us. Only the gods, Kantaks. Kantas, Ken." He suddenly realized what this confused sermon was about, holding him here, holding him so the mummy could catch up and choke him to death. He stepped forward, seized the raving head, and squeezed it between his fingers. He surprised himself by laughing as he did it, because it was so much like the stuff the crazy cable TV preachers did. They grabbed their victims upside the head and bellowed stuff like, "Sickness, come out! Tumors, come out! Rheumatiz, come out! In the name of Jesus!" There was another of those soundless flashes, and this time not even the body was left. He was alone on the path again. He walked on, sorrow working at his heart and mind, thinking of what the mother thing had said. "No heaven. No afterlife at all, not for such as us." That might be true or it might not be. He had no way of knowing. But the thing had also said that God had allowed his mother and sister to be killed, and that was true. Wasn't it? Well, maybe. How's a kid supposed to know about stuff like that? Ahead was the oak tree with the Viet Cong lookout in it. At the base of the tree was a piece of red and silver paper. A Three Muskies wrapper. David bent over, picked it up, and stuck it in his mouth, sucking the smears of sweet chocolate off the inside with his eyes closed. "Take, eat," he heard Reverend Martin say. This was a memory and not a voice, which was something of a relief. "This is my body, broken for you and for many." He opened his eyes, fearing he might nevertheless see Reverend Martin's drunken face and dead eyes, but Reverend Martin wasn't there. David spat the wrapper out and climbed to the Viet Cong lookout with the sweet taste of chocolate in his mouth. He climbed into the sound of rock and roll music. Someone was sitting cross-legged on the platform and looking out at the Bear Street woods. His posture was so similar to Brian's, legs crossed, chin propped on the palms of his hands, that for a moment David was sure it was his old friend, only grown to young adulthood. David thought he could handle that. It wouldn't be any stranger than the rotting effigy of his mother, or the cougar with Audrey Wyler's head, and a hell of a lot less distressing. Slung over the young man's shoulder was a radio on a strap. Not a Walkman or a boombox. It looked older than either. There were two circular decals pasted to its leather case, one a yellow smile guy, the other the peace sign. The music was coming from a small exterior speaker. The sound was tinny but still way cool. Hot drums, killer rhythm guitar, and a somehow perfect rock and roll vocal. "I was feeling so bad. Asked my family doctor just what I had." "Bry?" he asked, grabbing the bottom of the platform and pulling himself up. "That you?" The man turned. He was slim, dark-haired under a Yankees baseball cap, wearing jeans, a plain gray T-shirt, and big reflector shades. David could see his own face in them. He was the first person David had seen in this, whatever it was, that he didn't know. "Brian's not here, David," he said. "Who are you, then?" If the guy in the reflector sunglasses started to rot or to bleed out like in Trajan, David was vacating this tree in a hurry, and never mind the mummy that might be lurking somewhere in the woods below. "This is our place, mine and Bri's." "Brian can't be here," the dark-haired man said pleasantly. "Brian's alive, you see." "I don't get you," but he was afraid he did. "What did you tell Marinville when he tried to talk to the coyotes?" It took David a moment to remember, and that wasn't surprising because what he'd said hadn't seemed to come from him, but through him. "I said not to speak to them in the language of the dead, except it wasn't really me who..." The man in the sunglasses waved this off. "The way Marinville tried to speak to the coyotes is sort of the way we're speaking now. CM, Toan Candy Latch, do you understand?" "Yes. We speak the language of the unformed, the language of the dead." David began to shiver. "I'm dead too, then, aren't I? I'm dead too." "Nope. Wrong. Lose one turn." The man turned up the volume on his radio. "I said, Doctor, Mr. M.D., and smiled. "The Rascals," he said. "Felix Cavalieri on vocals. Cool?" "Yes," David said, and meant it. He felt he could listen to the song all day. It made him think of the beach and cute girls in two-piece bathing suits. The man in the Yankees cap listened a moment longer, then turned the radio off. When he did, David saw a ragged scar on the underside of his right wrist, as if at some point he had tried to kill himself. Then it occurred to him that the man might have done a lot more than just try. Wasn't this a place of the dead? He suppressed a shiver. The man took off his Yankees cap, wiped the back of his neck with it, put it back on, and looked at David seriously. "This is the land of the dead, but you're an exception. You're special. Very. Who are you?" "It doesn't matter. Just another member of the Young Rascals Felix Cavalieri fan club, if it comes to that," the man said. He looked around, sighed, grimaced a little. "But I'll tell you one thing, young man. It doesn't surprise me at all that the land of the dead should turn out to be located in the suburbs of Columbus, Ohio." He looked back at David, his faint smile fading. "I guess it's time we got down to business. Time is short. You're going to have a bit of a sore throat when you wake up, by the way, and you may feel disoriented at first. They're moving you to the back of the truck Steve Ames drove into town. They feel a strong urge to vacate the American West, take it any way you want, and I can't say I blame them." "Why are you here?" "To make sure you know why you're here, David, to begin with, at least. So tell me, why are you here?" "I don't know what you're..." "Oh, please," the man with the radio said. His mirror shades flashed in the sun. "If you don't, you're in deep shit. Why are you on Earth? Why did God make you?" David looked at him in consternation. "Come on, come on," the man said impatiently. "These are easy questions. Why did God make you? Why did God make me? Why did God make anyone?" "To love and serve him," David said slowly. "Okay, good. It's a start, anyway. And what is God? What's your experience of the nature of God?" "I don't want to say." David looked down at his hands, then up at the grave, intent man, the strangely familiar man, in the sunglasses. "I'm scared I'll get in Dutch." He hesitated, then dragged out what he was really afraid of. "I'm scared you're God." The man uttered a short, rueful laugh. "In a way, that's pretty funny, but never mind. Let's stay focused here. What do you know of the nature of God, David? What is your experience?" With the greatest reluctance, David said, "God is cruel." He looked down at his hands again and counted slowly to five. When he had reached it and still hadn't been fried by a lightning bolt, he looked up again. The man in the jeans and T-shirt was still grave and intent, but David saw no anger in him. "That's right. God is cruel. We slow down, the mummy always catches us in the end, and God is cruel. Why is God cruel, David?" For a moment, he didn't answer, and then something Reverend Martin had said came to him. The TV in the corner had been broadcasting a soundless spring training baseball game that day. "God's cruelty is refining," he said. "Where the mine and God is the miner?" "Well, and all cruelty is good? God is good and cruelty is good?" "No, hardly any of it's good," David said. For a single horrified second, he saw Pi dangling from the hook on the wall. Pi, who had walked around ants on the sidewalk because she didn't want to hurt them. "What has cruelty done for evil?" "Malice. Who are you, sir?" "Never mind. Who is the father of malice?" "The devil, or maybe those other gods my mother talked about." "Never mind Kanta and Kantak, at least for now. We have bigger fish to fry, so pay attention." "What is faith?" That one was easy. "The substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." "Yeah. And what is the spiritual state of the faithful?" "Love and acceptance, I think." "And what is the opposite of faith?" That was tougher, a real hairball, in fact, like one of those damned reading achievement tests. Pick A, B, C, or D, except here you didn't even get the choices. "Disbelief?" he ventured. "No, not disbelief, but unbelief. The first is natural, the second willful. And when one is in unbelief, David, what is that one's spiritual state?" He thought about it, then shook his head. "I don't know." "Yes, you do." He thought about it and realized he did. "The spiritual state of unbelief is desperation." "Yes." "Look down, David." He did, and was shocked to see that the Viet Cong lookout was no longer in the tree. It now floated, like a magic carpet made out of boards, above a vast, blighted countryside. He could see buildings here and there amid rows of gray and listless plants. One was a trailer with a bumper sticker proclaiming the owner a Snapple-drinking, Clinton-bashing son of a bitch. Another was the mining Quonset they'd seen on their way into town. Another was the municipal building. Another was Bud's Suds. The grinning leprechaun with the pot of gold under his arm peered out of a dead and strangulated jungle. "This is the poison field," the man in the reflector sunglasses said. "What's gone on here makes Agent Orange look like sugar candy. There will be no sweetening this earth. It must be eradicated, sown with salt and plowed under. Do you know why?" "Because it will spread?" "No, it can't. Evil is both fragile and stupid, dying soon after the ecosystem it's poisoned." "Then why?" "Because it's an affront to God. There is no other reason. Nothing hidden or held back, no fine print. The poison field is a perversity and an affront to God. Now look down again." He did. The buildings had slipped behind them. Now the Viet Cong lookout floated above a vast pit. From this perspective, it looked like a sore which has rotted through the skin of the earth and into its underlying flesh. The sides sloped inward and downward in neat zigzags like stairs. In a way, looking into this place was like looking into, walk a little faster, a pyramid turned inside out. There were pines in the hills south of the pit, and some growth high up around the edges, but the pit itself was sterile. Not even juniper grew here. On the near side, it would be the north face, David supposed, if the poison field was the town of desperation. These neat setbacks had broken through near the bottom. Where they had been, there was now a long slope of stony rubble. At the site of the landslide, and not too far from the broad gravel road leading down from the rim of the pit, there was a black and gaping hole. The sight of it made David profoundly uneasy. It was as if a monster buried in the desert ground had opened one eye. The landslide surrounding it made him uneasy, too, because it looked somehow, well, planned. At the bottom of the pit, just below the ragged hole, was a parking area filled with ore freighters, diggers, pickup trucks, and tread-equipped vehicles that looked sort of like World War II tanks. Nearby stood a rusty Quonset hut with a stove stack sticking crooked out of the roof. "Welcome to Rattlesnake Number 2," read the sign on the door. "Providing jobs and tax dollars to Central Nevada since 1951. Off to the left of the metal building was a squat concrete cube. The sign on this one was briefer. "Powder Magazine. Authorized personnel only." Parked between the two buildings was Collie and Trajan's road-dusty Caprice. The driver's door stood open, and the dome light was on, illuminating an interior that looked like an abattoir. On the dash, a plastic bear with a knotty head had been stuck beside the compass. Then all that was sliding behind them. "You know this place, don't you, David?" "Is it the China Pit?" "It is, isn't it?" "Yes." They swooped closer to the side, and David saw that the pit was, in its way, even more desolate than the poison field. There were no whole stones or outcrops in the earth, at least not that he could see. Everything had been reduced to an awful yellow rubble. Beyond the parking area and the buildings were vast heaps of even more radically crumbled rock, piled on black plastic. "Those are waste dumps," his guide remarked. "The stuff piled on the plastic is gang. Spoil. But the company's not ready to let it rest, even now. There's more in it, you see. Gold, silver, molybdenum, platinum, and copper, of course. Mostly it's copper. Deposits so diffuse, it's as if they were blown in there like smoke. Mining it used to be uneconomic, but as the world's major deposits of ore and metal are depleted, what used to be uneconomic becomes profitable. The oversized hefty bags are collection pads. The stuff they want precipitates out onto them, and they just scrape it off. It's a leaching process. Spell it either way, and it comes to the same. They'll go on working the ground until all of this, which used to be a mountain almost 8,000 feet high, is just dust in the wind. What are those big steps coming down the side of the pit?" "Benches. They serve as ring roads for heavy equipment around the pit, but their major purpose is to minimize earth slides." "It doesn't look like it worked very well back there." David hooked a thumb over his shoulder. "Up here, either." They were nearing another area where the look of vast stairs descending into the earth was obliterated by a tilted range of crumbled rock. "That's a slope failure." The Viet Cong lookout swooped above the slide area. Beyond it, David saw networks of black stuff that at first looked like cobwebs. As they drew nearer, he saw that the strands of what looked like cobwebbing were actually PVC pipe. "Just lately, it's been a switchover from rainbirds to emitters." His guide spoke in the tone of one who recites rather than speaks. David had a moment of deja vu, then realized why. The man was repeating what Audrey Weiler had already said. "A few eagles died." "A few?" David asked, giving Mr. Billingsley's line. "All right, about 40 in all. No big deal in terms of the species. There's no shortage of eagles in Nevada. Do you see what they replaced the rainbirds with, David? The big pipes are distribution heads. Canned tacks, let's say. Big gods." "Yes, and those little hollow cords that stretch between them like mesh, those are emitters, cantas. They drip weak sulfuric acid. It frees the ore and rots the ground. Hang on, David." The Viet Cong lookout banked, also like a flying carpet, with David holding onto the edge of the boards to keep from tumbling off. He didn't want to fall onto that terrible gouged ground where nothing grew and streams of brackish fluid flowed down to the plastic collection pads. They sank into the pit again and passed above the rusty Quonset with the stove stack, the powder magazine, and the cluster of machinery where the road ended. Up the slope, above the gaping hole, was a wide area pocked with other, much smaller holes. David thought there had to be 50 of them at least, probably more. From each poked a yellow-tipped stick. "Looks like the world's biggest gopher colony." "This is a blast face, and those are blast holes," his new acquaintance lectured. "The active mining is going on right here. Each of these holes is 3 feet in diameter and about 30 feet deep. When you're getting ready to shoot, you lower a stick of dynamite with a blasting cap on it to the bottom of each hole. That's the igniter. Then you pour in a couple of wheelbarrows worth of ANFO, stands for ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. Those assholes who blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City used ANFO. It usually comes in pellets that look like white BBs." The man in the Yankees cap pointed to the powder magazine. "Lots of ANFO in there. No dynamite. They used up the last on the day all this started to happen. But plenty of ANFO." "I don't understand why you're telling me this." "Never mind. Just listen. Do you see the blast holes?"
"Yes. They look like eyes."
"That's right. Holes like eyes. They're sunk into the porphyry, which is crystalline. When the ANFO is detonated, it shatters the rock. The shattered stuff contains the ore. Get it?"
"Yes, I think so."
"That material is trucked away to the leach pads. The distribution heads and emitters, Can-Ta, Can-Tac, are laid over it, and the rotting process begins. Voila! There you have it. Leach ore mining at its very finest. But see what the last blast pattern uncovered, David." He pointed at the big hole, and David felt an unpleasant, debilitating coldness begin to creep through him. The hole seemed to stare up at him with a kind of idiot invitation.
"What is it?"
he whispered, but he supposed he knew. "Rattlesnake number one, also known as the China Mine, or the China Shaft, or the China Drift. The last series of shots uncovered it. To say the crew was surprised would be an understatement, because nobody in the Nevada mining business really believes that old story. By the turn of the century, the Diablo Company was claiming that number one was simply shut down when the vein played out. But it's been here, David, all along. And now..."
"Is it haunted?" David asked, shivering.
"It is, isn't it?"
"Oh, yes," the man in the Yankees cap said, turning his silvery no-eyes on David.
"Yes, indeed."
"Whatever you brought me up here for, I don't want to hear it," David cried. "I want you to take me back to my dad. I hate this. I hate being in the land of the..."
He broke off as a horrible thought struck him. The land of the dead. That was what the man had said. He'd called David an exception. But that meant...
"Reverend Martin. I saw him on my way to the woods. Is he..."
The man looked briefly down at his old-fashioned radio, then looked back up again and nodded. "2 days after you left, David."
"Was he drunk?"
"Toward the end, he was always drunk. Like Billingsley."
"Was it suicide?"
"No," the man in the Yankees cap said, and put a kindly hand on the back of David's neck. It was warm, not the hand of a dead person. At least, not conscious suicide. He and his wife went to the beach. They took a picnic. He went in the water too soon after lunch and swam out too far.
"Take me back," David whispered. "I'm tired of all this death."
"The poison field is an affront to God," the man said. "I know it's a bummer, David, but..."
"Then let God clean it up," David cried. "It's not fair for him to come to me after he killed my mother and my sister."
"He didn't..."
"I don't care. I don't care. Even if he didn't, he stood aside and let it happen. That's not true either.
David shut his eyes and clapped his hands to his ears. He didn't want to hear any more. He refused to hear any more. Yet the man's voice came through anyway. It was relentless. He would be able to escape it no more than Jonah had been able to escape God. God was as relentless as a bloodhound on a fresh scent. And God was cruel. "Why are you on earth?" The voice seemed to come from inside his head now.
"I don't hear you. I don't hear you."
"You were put on earth to love God?"
"No!"
"And serve him?"
"No! Fuck God! Fuck his love! Fuck his service!"
"God can't make you do anything you don't want to do."
"Stop it! I won't listen! I won't decide! Do you hear? Do you..."
"Shh! Listen." Not quite against his will, David listened. Part 4. The China Pit. God is cruel. Chapter 1. 1. Johnny was ready to suggest that they just get going. Cynthia could hold the kid's head in her lap and cushion it from any bumps. When David raised his hands and pressed the heels of his palms to his temples, he took a deeper breath. A moment later, his eyes opened and looked up at them. Johnny, Steve, Cynthia, his father. The faces of the two older men were as puffed and discolored as those of journeyman fighters after a bad night in a tank town. All of them looked tired and scared, jumping like spooked horses at the slightest sound. The ragtag remains of the Collie and Tragian Survival Society.
"Hi, David," Johnny said. "Great to have you back. You're in Steve's truck, parked near the movie theater. You brought it down from the Conoco station."
David struggled to a sitting position, swallowed, winced. "She must have shook me like dice."
"She did," Steve said. He was looking at David cautiously. "You remember Audrey doing that?"
"No," David said, "but I was told." Johnny shot a glance at Ralph, who shrugged slightly. "Don't ask me."
"Is there any water? My throat's on fire."
"We got out of the theater in a hurry and didn't bring anything but the guns," Cynthia said. "But there's this." She pointed to a case of Jolt Cola, from which several bottles had already been taken. "Steve keeps it on hand for Mr. Marinville."
"I'm a freak about it since I quit drinking," Johnny said. "Gotta be Jolt. God knows why. It's warm, but..."
David took one and drank deeply, wincing as the carbonation bit into his throat, but not slowing down on that account. At last, with the bottle three-quarters empty, he put his head back against the side of the truck, closed his eyes, and burped ringingly. Johnny grinned.
60 points!
David opened his eyes and grinned back. Johnny held out the bottle of aspirin he had liberated from the owls. "Want a couple? They're old, but they seem to work all right." David thought it over, then took two and washed them down with the rest of the jolt.
"We're getting out," Johnny said. "We'll try north first. There are some trailers in the road, but Steve says he thinks we can get around them on the trailer park side."
"If we can't, we'll have to go south to the pit mine and then take the equipment road that runs northwest from there back to Highway 50. You and I'll sit up front with..."
"No."
Johnny raised his eyebrows.
"Pardon?
We have to go up to the mine, okay, but not to leave town." David's voice sounded hoarse, as if he'd been crying. "We have to go down inside the pit." Johnny glanced at Steve, who only shrugged and then looked back at the boy.
"What are you talking about, David?" Steve asked. "Your mother? Because it would probably be better for her, not to mention the rest of us, if we..." "No, that's not why. Dad?"
The boy reached out and took his father's hand. It was an oddly adult gesture of comfort.
"Mom's dead."
Ralph bowed his head.
Well, we don't know that for sure, David, and we mustn't give up hope, but I guess it's likely.
I do know for sure. I'm not just guessing.
David's face was haggard in the light of the crisscrossing flashlight beams. His eyes settled on Johnny last.
There's stuff we have to do. You know it, don't you? That's why you waited for me to wake up.
No, David, not at all. We just didn't want to risk moving you until we were sure you were okay.
Yet this felt like a lie to his heart. He found himself filling up with a vague, fluttery nervousness. It was the way he felt in the last few days before beginning a new book, when he understood that the inevitable could not be put off much longer, that he would soon be out on the wire again, clutching his balance pole and riding his stupid little unicycle. But this was worse, by far. He felt an urge to bop the kid over the head with the butt of the Rossi shotgun, knock him out and shut him up before he could say anything else.
"Don't you fuck us up, kid," he thought, "not when we're starting to see a tiny bit of light at the end of the tunnel."
David looked back at his father. He was still holding Ralph's hand.
"She's dead, but not at rest. She can't be as long as Tack inhabits her body."
"Who's Tack, David?" Cynthia asked.
"One of the Wintergreen twins," Johnny said cheerfully. "The other one's Tick."
David gave him a long, level look, and Johnny dropped his eyes. He hated himself for doing it, but couldn't help it.
"Tack is a god," David said, "or a demon, or maybe nothing at all, just a name, a nonsense syllable, but a dangerous nothing, like a voice in the wind. It doesn't matter. What does is that my mom should be put to rest. Then she can be with my sister in, well, in wherever there is for us after we die.
Son, what matters is that we have to get out of here," Johnny said. He was still managing to keep his voice gentle, but now he could hear an undercurrent of impatience and fear in it.
"Once we get to Ely, we'll contact the state police. Hell, the FBI. There'll be 100 cops on the ground and 12 helicopters in the air by noon tomorrow. That I promise you. But for now..."
"My mom's dead, but Mary's not," David said. "She's still alive. She's in the pit."
Cynthia gasped. "How did you know she was even gone?"
David smiled wanly. "Well, I don't see her, for one thing. The rest I know the same way I know it was Audrey who choked me. I was told."
"By who, David?" Ralph asked.
"I don't know," David said. "I don't even know if it matters. What matters is that he told me stuff. True stuff. I know it was."
"Story hour's over, pal," Johnny said. There was a raggedness in his voice. He heard it, but he couldn't help it. And was it surprising? This wasn't a panel discussion on magical realism or concrete prose, after all. Story hour was finished. Bug-out time had arrived. He had absolutely no desire to listen to a bunch of shit from this spooky little Jesus scout.
The Jesus scout slid out of his cell somehow, killed the coyote and Tragian set as a guard, and saved your miserable life, Terry spoke up inside his head. Maybe you should listen to him, Johnny. And that, he thought, was why he had divorced Terry in the first place. In a fucking nutshell, she had been a divine lay, but she had never known when to shut up and listen to her intellectual betters. But the damage was done. It was now too late to derail this train of thought. He found himself thinking of what Billingsley had said about David's escape from the jail cell. Not even Houdini. Hadn't that been it? Because of the head. And then there was the phone, the way he'd sent the coyotes packing, and the matter of the sardines and crackers. The thought which had gone through his own head had been something about unobtrusive miracles, hadn't it? He had to quit thinking that way, because what Jesus scouts did was get people killed. Look at John the Baptist, or those nuns in South America, or...
Not even Houdini. Because of the head.
Johnny realized there was no point in gilding the lily, or doing little mental tap dances, or, this was the oldest trick of all,
using different voices to argue the question into incoherence. The simple fact was that he was no longer just afraid of the cop or the other forces which might be loose in this town. He was also afraid of David Carver. "It wasn't really the cop who killed my mother and sister and Mary's husband," David said, and gave Johnny a look that reminded him eerily of Terry. That look used to drive him to the edge of insanity. "You know what I'm talking about," it said. "You know exactly, so don't waste my time by being deliberately obtuse. And whoever I talked to while I was unconscious, it was really God. Only God can't come to people as himself. He'd scare them to death and never get any business done at all. He comes as other stuff. Birds, pillars of fire, burning bushes, whirlwinds." "Or people," Cynthia said. "Sure, God's a master of disguise." The last of Johnny's patience broke at the skinny girl's "make sense to me" tone. "This is totally insane," he shouted. "We have to get gone, don't you see that? We're parked on goddamn Main Street, shut up in here without a single window to look out of. He could be anywhere, up front behind the fucking wheel for all we know, or, I don't know, coyotes? Buzzards?" "He's gone," David said in his quiet voice. He leaned forward and took another jolt from the case. "Who?" Johnny asked. "Entragian?" "The Cantac. It doesn't matter who it's in, Entragian or my mother or the one it started with. It's always the same. Always the Cantac, the big god, the guardian. Gone. Can't you feel it?" "I don't feel anything." "Don't be a gonzo," Terry said in his mind. "Don't be a gonzo," David said, looking intently up at him. The bottle of jolt was clasped loosely in his hands. Johnny bent toward him. "Are you reading my mind?" he asked, almost pleasantly. "If you are, I'll thank you to get the hell out of my head, sonny." "What I'm doing is trying to get you to listen," David said. "Everyone else will, if you will. He doesn't need to send his cantas or cantac against us if we're in disagreement with one another. If there's a broken window, he'll get in and tear us apart." "Come on," Johnny said. "Don't go all guilt-trippy. None of this is my fault." "I'm not saying it is. Just listen, okay?" David sounded almost pleading. "You can do that this time because he's gone. The trailers he put in the road are gone, too. Don't you get it? He wants us to leave." "Great. Let's give him what he wants."
"Let's listen to what David has to say," Steve said.
Johnny wheeled on him. "I think you must have forgotten who pays you, Steve." He loathed the sound of the words as soon as they were out of his mouth, but made no effort to take them back. The urge to get out of here, to jump behind the wheel of the Ryder truck and just roll some miles, in any direction but south, was now so strong it was nearly panic.
"You told me to stop calling you boss. I'm holding you to that."
"Besides, what about Mary?" Cynthia asked. "He says she's alive." Johnny turned toward her, turned on her. "You may want to pack your suitcases and travel Transgod Airways with David, but I think I'll pass."
"We'll listen to him," Ralph said in a low voice.
Johnny stared at him, amazed. If he had expected help from anyone, it had been from the boy's father. "He's all I got," Ralph had said in the lobby of the American West. "All that's left of my family." Johnny looked around at the others and was dismally astounded to see they were in agreement. Only he stood apart. And Steve had the keys to the truck in his pocket. Yet it was him the boy was mostly looking at. Him. As it was him, John Edward Merinville, that people had been mostly looking at ever since he had published his first novel at the impossibly precocious age of 22. He thought he had gotten used to it, and maybe he had, but this time it was different. He had an idea that none of the others, the teachers, the readers, the critics, the editors, the drinking buddies, the women, had ever wanted what this boy seemed to want, which was not just for him to listen. Listening, Johnny was afraid,
was only where it would start. The eyes were not just looking, though. The eyes were pleading.
"Forget it, kid," he thought. "When people like you drive, the bus always seems to crash."
"If it wasn't for David, I think your personal bus would have crashed already," Terry said from Derbichen Bunker inside his head. "I think you'd be dead and hung up on a hook somewhere. Listen to him, Johnny. For Christ's sake, listen."
In a much lower voice, Johnny said, "Entragian's gone. You're sure of that?"
"Yes," David said. "The animals, too. The coyotes and wolves, hundreds of them it must have taken, maybe thousands, moved the trailers off the road, dumped them over the side and onto the hard pan. Now most of them have drawn away, into me him, the watchman's circle." He drank from the bottle of Jolt. The hand holding it shook slightly. He looked at each of them in turn, but it was Johnny his eyes came back to. Always Johnny. "He wants what you want, for us to leave."
"Then why did he bring us here in the first place?"
"He didn't."
"What?"
"He thinks he did, but he didn't."
"I don't have any idea what you're..."
"God brought us," David said, "to stop him."
2.
In the silence which followed this, Steve discovered he was listening for the wind outside. There was none. He thought he could hear a plane far away, sane people on their way to some sane destination, sleeping or eating U.S. News and World Report. But that was all. It was Johnny who broke the silence, of course, and although he sounded as confident as ever, there was a look in his eyes, a slidey look, that Steve didn't like much. He thought he liked Johnny's crazed look better, the wide eyes and terrified Clyde Barrow grin he'd had on when he put the shotgun up to the cougar's ear and blew its head off. That there was a half-bright outlaw inside Johnny was something Steve knew very well. He'd seen flickers of that guy from the start of the tour, and knew it was the outlaw Bill Harris had feared when he laid down the Five Commandments that day in Jack Appleton's office. But Clyde Barrow seemed to have stepped out and left the other Marinville, the one with the satiric eyebrow and the windbag William F. Buckley rhetoric, in his place.
"You speak as if we all had the same God, David," he said. "I don't mean to patronize you, but I hardly think that's the case."
"But it is the case," David replied calmly. "Compared to Tack, you and a cannibal king would have the same God. You've seen the Cantas, I know you have, and you've felt what they can do." Johnny's mouth twitched, indicating, Steve thought, that he had taken a hit but didn't want to admit it.
"Perhaps that's so," he said, "but the person who brought me here was a long way from God. He was a big blonde policeman with skin problems. He planted a bag of dope in my saddlebag and then beat the shit out of me."
"Yes, I know. The dope came from Mary's car. He put something like nails in the road to get us. It's funny when you think about it. Funny weird, not ha-ha. He went through desperation like a whirlwind. Shot people, stabbed them, beat them, pushed them out windows, ran them down with his car. But he still couldn't just come up to us, any of us, and take out his gun and say, 'You're coming with me.' He had to have a... I don't know the word." He looked at Johnny.
"Pretext," Steve's erstwhile boss said.
"Yes, right, a pretext. It's like how, in the old horror movies, a vampire can't just come in on his own. You have to invite him in."
"Why?"
Cynthia asked. "Maybe because Entragian, the real Entragian, was still inside his head, like a shadow, or a person that's locked out of his house but can still look in the windows and pound on the doors. Now Tack's in my mother, what's left of her, and it would kill us if it could, but it could probably still make the best key lime pie in the world, too, if it wanted to." David looked down for a moment, his lips trembling, then looked back up at them. "Him needing a pretext to take us doesn't really matter. Many times what he does or says doesn't matter. It's nonsense or impulse.
Although there are clues, always clues, he gives himself away, shows his real self, like someone who says what he sees in ink blots.
Steve asked, "If that doesn't matter, what does?"
That he took us and let other people